Welcome to another quick and condensed version of American History for the Modern Patriot. This is Dr. Susan Rempel. Please support this podcast by purchasing one of the games or teaching tools for as little as 76 cents on my website, bingoforpatriots.com, or choose from one of more than 100 different bingo games with educational, religious, holiday, and party themes on my other website, uncommoncourtesy.com. Prices for those games start at just $1.99. Thank you so much in advance for supporting my work. Which English monarchs demonstrated the usurpation of individual rights resulting from despotic leadership? Which royal governors gave the founders an up-close view of the results of oppression upon a people by a leader who cared little for their individual rights? We will answer those questions in this podcast. Why were our founders so wary of adding an executive into our governmental structure? I believe that you have to examine the context of a situation in order to understand why a particular event occurred. In this case, the founders only needed to examine the history of their mother country in order to see the effects of a tyrannical leader. Let's learn about some of the egregious behavior exhibited by several of the English monarchs. It will give you a glimpse into why the colonists were so wary of installing an executive or an executive branch. Of course, the colonists knew all too well about the system of government that existed in Great Britain. That government had transformed over time from an absolute monarchy into a constitutional monarchy. An absolute monarchy is similar to a dictatorship. Although King George III ruled the British Empire, he did so within a set of parameters outlined in a variety of documents. The first of those documents was the Magna Carta. Complete with 63 clauses, the Magna Carta was issued by King John in 1215. But the good king, who is often associated with the English folklore hero Robin Hood, did not issue those clauses willingly. He and his circle of advisors believed that his power was given to him by God and was known for his cruelty and bad temperament. Eventually, a group of barons forced him into agreeing to the terms of the Magna Carta. One term allowed for them to make war against him if they believed he was not complying with the agreement. Is it any surprise that after only a few contentious years, John and the barons took to their weapons? John died during the civil war that resulted from their disagreements. Let's move forward to the 1600s, when tyranny once again was in full force and effect during the rule of Charles I. He believed in the divine right of kings and thought he could use his royal prerogative to impose customs duties and forced loans on his subjects. He carried his Parliament be damned attitude too far when he imprisoned people who refused to pay the imposed upon loans. Further, he began to espouse views that were a bit, quote, too Catholic for his primarily Anglican subjects after his marriage to Henrietta Maria of France. In 1628, the Parliament refused to grant any future taxes until Charles agreed to the Petition of Right. The Petition of Right was intended not only to restrict the ruler's ability to impose taxes without the consent of the Parliament, but to rule the quartering of soldiers, the imposition of martial law, and arbitrary imprisonment unlawful as well. True to his tyrannical rule, when Parliament attempted to take action against the king's behavior, he chose to dissolve it. As a result of his absolutist actions, both the English and Scottish parliaments brought up armies to fight against him in the English Civil War. Led by Oliver Cromwell's New Model Army, the unrepentant Charles was captured, tried, and eventually executed in 1649. Although Charles had been undone by a revolt championed by Oliver Cromwell, Cromwell himself behaved much like a tyrant by sending forces to brutally massacre several towns in Ireland under the pretense of, quote, the righteous judgment of God. Eventually, he had himself declared Lord Protector in 1653. When he died of malaria in 1658, he was immensely popular and given a funeral fit for a king. However, within 3 years, his reputation had descended to that of a villain, and his exhumed body was hung from a tree. The British restored the monarchy, and Charles II assumed the throne. Yet again, in 1685, the British experienced rule by a tyrant. Apparently undeterred by what befell his grandfather, James II professed faith in the divine right of kings. He also expressed sympathy towards the Catholic faith. In what is referred to as the Glorious Revolution, James fled England in 1688. The Parliament snatched the crown from him and offered it to his eldest daughter, who happened to be Protestant. The Parliament quickly passed a Bill of Rights the next year. It limited the power of the monarchy, detailed the rights of Parliament, and guaranteed things such as free elections. It allowed Protestants to arm themselves to defend the rule of law and prohibited cruel and unusual punishment. It also dealt with issues pertaining to succession of the crown. Unfortunately, both James' sister Mary and his younger sister Anne were childless, and the other living members of the House of Stuart were Catholic. In response to that situation, and quite fed up with the divine right of kings' tyrannical mindset, the Parliament passed the Act of Settlement in 1701. It disqualified Catholics, as well as those married to a Catholic, from the throne. It also required that the monarch make decisions in consultation with a council of constitutional advisers, rather than one of his own or in conjunction with personal advisers. Given the copious examples of monarchs who thought it was within their divine right to abuse their subjects, you might think that those whom the British placed in power over the colonies would take care to assure the people's rights as Englishmen. However, there are numerous examples of men behaving in ways that are eerily similar to the good kings John, Charles, and James. Let's learn just a smattering about some of the provincial governors whom were most despised by the colonists. Let's begin with Edward Hyde. Hyde was sent to represent the crown in the same year that the Act of Settlement had passed. He was the first royal governor of New Jersey, and one year later assumed that position in New York as well. Surely a man who was placed in charge of not one but two colonies would be benevolent, or at least stable. However, Hyde pilfered the pockets of the colonists he ruled over and behaved very badly as well. Hyde was described by one historian as an atrocious combination of arrogance and intellectual imbecility. He insisted on being referred to as His High Mightiness. He took large sums of money from the public treasury and accepted bribes from individuals as well. Much like King Charles, Hyde dissolved the New York Assembly not once, not twice, but three times. However, perhaps what was the final straw in the Queen calling him back to England was his flamboyant and erratic nature. He occasionally hid in bushes and then pounced upon unsuspecting passers-by. He even delivered a speech at the opening of the New York Assembly in 1702 while wearing a hooped gown ensemble complete with a fan and headdress. When those present questioned his garb, he replied, quote, "You are all very stupid people not to see the propriety of it all. In this place and occasion I represent a woman, and in all respects I ought to represent her as faithfully as I can." Edward Hyde was recalled to England by the Queen after having been jailed. He was later tried for corruption. Another transplanted Englishman who sought to rule with an iron fist over the people was John Murray. Murray is best known by his title of Lord Dunmore. He was appointed as New York's governor in 1770, but it was in his role as the royal governor of Virginia in which he best exemplified the behavior of a tyrant. Dunmore haplessly issued a proclamation forbidding the colonists to form or send a committee to the Second Continental Congress. Like Charles I, he dissolved the House of Burgesses as well. But it was in April 1775 when he displayed his true colors. Dunmore ordered that the powder from the colonists' stockpile in Williamsburg be seized in the middle of the night. Luckily, the soldiers were discovered and chased back to their ship with only 15 barrels of powder. Lord Dunmore was then unmoved by arguments that the powder should be returned. He responded that the powder had been moved due to an insurrection in a neighboring county, and added that because the residents of Williamsburg had been prepared to take up arms in response to the powder's relocation, it might not be a good idea for them to have access to the powder at all. The situation again escalated when troops landed on shore, and it was assumed they intended to completely empty the powder house. The townspeople were once again prepared to take up arms. However, they were calmed by notables amongst them. Unfortunately, there was no one to calm Lord Dunmore. He issued another message that further colonial threats would be responded to by burning the town and freeing all the slaves who were willing to join the British forces against the locals in Virginia. Ultimately, he and his family fled from Williamsburg and began living on a ship in the Chesapeake Bay. They left once and for all in 1776 and eventually returned to Britain. Let's learn about one more tyrannical figure who was reviled even more than Lord Dunmore. His name was Thomas Hutchinson. Hutchinson was actually born in Boston, which perhaps made him even more of a villain with fellow colonists. He served in a number of roles with the provincial legislature and even took part in the Albany Congress with Benjamin Franklin. But in 1752, things began to go wrong. Although not trained as an attorney, Hutchinson was appointed as a judge of a probate court. Simultaneously, he also served on the Inferior Court of Common Pleas. Later, he was appointed as the controller of the highest court in the colony. He then became the lieutenant governor of the colony, as well as becoming part of the governor's council. Eventually, he was appointed the governor of the entire colony. Although Hutchinson opposed the Stamp Act, he became the focal point of angry Bostonians. His home was destroyed by a mob in 1765. Although he tried in vain to satisfy demands made by his fellow colonists, as well as carrying out edicts for Britain, in June of 1773 his credibility was damaged irreparably. Letters written between Hutchinson and the lieutenant governor, Andrew Oliver, were published. The letters from Hutchinson ruminated about difficulties in leading the colony. However, Oliver openly stated his belief that the members of the governor's council should be appointed by the crown rather than being elected by the colonial assembly. Many had suspected that Hutchinson's loyalty was firmly set in the crown's corner. While the statements made by Oliver were much more damning, it was Hutchinson who felt the blunt force rage of many colonists. The cover image of this episode is demonstrative of that rage. It is the 1774 image drawn by Paul Revere entitled "The Wicked Statesman or the Traitor to His Country at the Hour of Death." The person depicted in that image was Thomas Hutchinson. Effigies of Hutchinson were hung and burned from the Boston Common. The Massachusetts Assembly petitioned for his removal. Hutchinson eventually fled to England and died there, purportedly homesick for his own country. Given what we've learned today, you can see there were copious examples for the founders to draw upon in which a single individual, whether a monarch or former rebel, who is left unrestrained, might very well assume the cloak of a tyrant. In the next edition, we will learn about one philosopher who influenced the founders. Until next time, this is Dr. Susan Rempel encouraging you to remain motivated, informed, and engaged in the political process.